Look at how bruised and papery the skin on her hands is. See how they shake? When my mom leans over to kiss me goodnight, I catch the smell of her face lotion. I feel the soft sheets under me and the warm blanket around me, and I breathe in deeply. I rarely make it to the exhale in peace, though. The ache paralyzes me with, "You know how this ends. When she goes, you will not survive." I don't know if the ache is trying to protect me or terrorize me. I don't know if it loves me or hates me, if it's bad or good. I just know that its role is to constantly remind me of the most essential fact of life, which is, this ends. Don't get too attached to anything. So when I get too soft, too comforted, too close to love, the ache reminds me. It always arrives in words, "She'll die," or an image, a phone call, a funeral, and immediately my body responds. I stiffen, hold my breath, straighten my spine, break eye contact, lean away. After that, I'm in control again. The ache keeps me prepared, distant, safe. The ache keeps me fine, which is another word for half dead. It takes a lot of effort for a live human being to stay half dead. For me, it also takes a lot of food. When I discover binging and purging at 10, food addiction becomes a whole life I can lead that has utterly nothing to do with actual life. Bulimia keeps me busy, distant, distracted. I plan my next binge all day, and when I find a private place to start eating, my frenzy becomes a raging waterfall inside and outside me, loud, much too loud for any interruption at all. There's no remembering, no ache, nothing but the binge. Then, just as I'm stuffed to the point of more nothingness, the purge. Another waterfall, more noise, nothing but noise until I'm on the floor, laid out, racked, too tired to feel or think or remember anything at all. Perfect. Bulimia is private. I need a way to silence the ache in public, too. That's what booze is for. Booze overpowers the ache. Instead of just interrupting love, it blocks it completely. No connection is real, so there is nothing risky for the ache to bother interrupting. Over the years, I learned that the bonus of booze is that it destroys all of my relationships before I can. You can't lose people who never even found you. By the time I turn 25, I have been arrested repeatedly. I cough up blood on a regular basis. My family has distanced themselves from me for their own protection. I have no feelings left, and I am nowhere near the land of the living, which is for fools and masochists. I am no fool. I have beaten life at its own game. I have learned how to exist without living at all, and I am completely free with nothing left to lose. I am also almost dead, but by God, I am safe. Take that, life. And then, that May morning, I find myself staring at that positive pregnancy test. I am certainly surprised by the pregnancy, but I'm absolutely stunned by my reaction to it. I feel inside me a deep desire to grow and birth and raise a person. These thoughts are foreign and baffling. I stand up and stare at my puffy, dirty face in the mirror and think, hold up, wait, what, you there in the mirror? You don't even like life. You don't even find it worth trying yourself. Why then are you suddenly desperate to bestow life upon another being as though it's some kind of gift? The only answer I have is, because I love it already. I want life for this being because I love this being. Why don't I want life for myself then? I want to be a being that I love too. The ache sweeps in with a ferocity. Danger, danger, don't be ridiculous. It becomes difficult to breathe. Yet there in that bathroom, dirty, sick, broken, aching, gasping, I still want to become a mother. That is how I learn that there is something deeper and truer and more powerful inside me than the ache. Because the deeper thing wins. The deeper thing is my desire to become a mother. This is what I want more than I want to stay safe. I want to be this being's mother. I decide right there on the floor to get sober and re-enter the land of the living. I suspect that the courage I muster up to make this decision is due, in large part, to the fact that I'm still wasted from the night before. I stand up and wobble out of the bathroom and into life. Life is exactly as I remembered it. Just the fucking worst. While I attempt to both become a human and grow a human at the exact same ridiculous time, I am also teaching third grade. By noon each day, I am dizzy with several sicknesses at once: morning sickness, withdrawal sickness, and the sickness of living without a daily escape plan. Each day at noon, I walk my class the long way to lunch so I can peek into my friend Josie's classroom and see the sign hung above her window, which says in big black block letters, "We can do hard things." "We can do hard things" becomes my hourly life mantra. It is my affirmation that living life on life's own absurd terms is hard. It isn't hard because I'm weak or flawed or because I made a wrong turn somewhere. It is hard because life is just hard for humans, and I am a human who is finally doing life right. "We can do hard things" insists that I can and should stay in the hard because there is some kind of reward for staying. I don't know what the reward is yet, but it feels true that there would be one, and I want to find out what it is. I am especially comforted by the "we" part. I don't know who the "we" is. I just need to believe that there is a "we" somewhere, either helping me through my hard things or doing their own hard things while I do mine. This is how I survive early sobriety, which turns out to be one long return of the ache. I say to myself every few minutes, "This is hard. We can do hard things." And then I do them. Fast forward 10 years. I have 3 children, a husband, a house, and a big career as a writer. I'm not just a sober, upstanding citizen. I'm kind of fancy, honestly. I am, by all accounts, humaning successfully. At a book signing during that time, a reporter approaches my father, points toward the long line of people waiting to meet me, and says, "You must be so proud of your daughter." My father looks at the reporter and says, "Honestly, we're just happy she's not in jail." We are all so happy I'm not in jail. One morning, I am in my closet getting dressed when my phone rings. I answer. It's my sister. She is speaking slowly and deliberately because she is between contractions. She says, "It's time, sissy. The baby's coming. Can you fly to Virginia now?" I say, "Yes, I can. I will come. I will be there soon." Then I hang up and stare at a large stack of jeans on my shelf. I am unsure of what to do next. During the past decade, I have learned how to do many hard things, but I still don't know how to do easy things, like book a flight. My sister usually does easy things for me. I think and decide that it is perhaps a less than ideal time to call her back and ask if she's aware of any good airline deals. I think some more and begin to wonder if anyone else's sister might be available to help me. Then the phone rings again. This time it's my mom. Her voice is slow and deliberate too. She says, "Honey, you need to come to Ohio right away. It's time to say goodbye to Grandma." I say nothing. She says, "Honey, are you there? Are you okay? How are you today, Glennon?" I'm still in my closet staring at my jeans. That's what I remember thinking first. I have a lot of jeans. Then, the ache becomes real and knocks on my door. My Grandma Alice is dying. I am being called to fly toward the dying. "How are you today, Glennon?" I do not say, "I'm fine, Mom." I say, "I'm not okay, but I'm coming. I love you." I hang up, walk to my computer, and Google how to buy plane tickets. I accidentally buy 3 tickets, but I'm still proud of myself. I walk back into my closet and begin to pack. I am both packing and watching myself pack, and my watching self is saying, "Wow, look at you. You are doing it. You look like a grown-up. Don't stop. Don't think. Just keep moving. We can do hard things. Surprisingly, now that the ache has transformed from idea to reality, I feel relatively steady. Dealing with the drop shoe is less paralyzing, apparently, than waiting for that shoe to drop. I call my sister and tell her I have to go to Ohio first. She already knows. My mom picks me up at the Cleveland airport and drives me to the retirement home. We are quiet and soft with each other. No one says she's fine. We arrive and walk through the loud lobby, then through the antiseptic-smelling hallway, and into my grandmother's warm, dark, Catholic room. I pass her motorized wheelchair and notice the gray duct tape covering the high-speed button, which she has lost her right to use because her hallway velocity has been scaring the other residents. I sit down in the chair next to my grandmother's bed. I touch the Mary statue on her bedside table, then the deep blue glass rosary beads draped over Mary's hands. I peek behind the table and see a small calendar hung there, the theme of which is hot priests. Each month's priest wears a full vestment and a smoldering smile. This calendar is a fundraiser for something or other. Charity has always been important to my grandmother. My mother stands several feet behind me, giving my grandmother and me time and space. I have never in my life felt the ache more deeply than I do in that moment, as my mother stands behind me, watching me touch each of her mother's things, knowing exactly which memory I am recalling with each lingering touch, knowing that her daughter is preparing to say goodbye to her mother, and that her mother is preparing to say goodbye to her daughter. My grandmother reaches over, rests her hand on mine, and looks at me deeply. This is when the ache becomes too powerful to resist. I am out of practice. I don't stiffen. I don't hold my breath. I don't break eye contact. I unclench and let it take me. First, it takes me to the thought that one day, not long after this, these roles will shift. I will be in my mother's place, watching my daughter say goodbye to my mother. Then, not too long from then, it will be my daughter watching her daughter say goodbye to me. I think these thoughts. I see these visions. I feel them too. They are hard and deep. The ache continues to take me with it, and now I am somewhere else. I am in the ache. I am in the one big ache of love, pain, beauty, tenderness, longing, goodbye, and I am here with my grandmother and my mother, and suddenly I understand that I am here with everyone else too. Somehow I am here with everyone who has ever lived and ever loved and ever lost. I have entered the place I thought was death, and it has turned out to be life itself. I entered this ache alone, but inside it I have found everyone. In surrendering to the ache of loneliness, I have discovered unloneliness. Right here, inside the ache, with everyone who has ever welcomed a child or held the hand of a dying grandmother or said goodbye to a great love, I am here with all of them. Here is the we that I recognized in Josie's sign. Inside the ache is the we. We can do hard things, like be alive and love deep and lose it all, because we do these things alongside everyone who has ever walked the earth with her eyes, arms, and heart wide open. The ache is not a flaw. The ache is our meeting place. It's the clubhouse of the brave. All the lovers are there. It is where you go alone to meet the world. The ache is love. The ache was never warning me, this ends, so leave. She was saying, this ends, so stay. I stayed. I held my grandmother Alice Flaherty's paper hands. I touched the wedding rings she still wore 26 years after my grandfather's death. I love you, honey, she said. I love you too, Grandma, I said. Take care of that baby for me, she said. That was it. I did not say anything remarkable at all. It turns out that a lot of goodbye is done in the touching of things, rosaries, hands, memories, love. I kissed my grandmother, felt her warm, soft forehead with my lips. Then I stood up and walked out of the room. My mother followed me. She shut the door behind us and we stood in the hallway and held each other and shook. We had taken a great journey together, to the place where brave people go, and it had changed us. My mom drove me back to the airport. I boarded another plane to Virginia. My dad picked me up and we drove to the birthing center. I walked into my sister's room and she looked over at me from her bed. Then she looked down at the bundle in her arms and up at me again. She said, "Sister, meet your niece, Alice Flaherty." I took baby Alice into my arms and we sat down in the rocking chair next to my sister's bed. First, I touched Alice Flaherty's hands, purple and papery. Next, I noticed her gray-blue eyes, which stared right into mine. They looked like the eyes of the master of the universe. They said to me, "Hello, here I am. Life goes on." Since I got sober, I have never been fine again, not for a single moment. I have been exhausted and terrified and angry. I have been overwhelmed and underwhelmed and debilitatingly depressed and anxious. I have been amazed and awed and delighted and overjoyed to bursting. I have been reminded constantly by the ache, "This will pass. Stay close." I have been alive. Ghosts. I was born a little broken with an extra dose of sensitivity. Some horseshit I wrote about myself in my first memoir. When I was in my 20s, I believed that somewhere there existed a perfect human woman. She woke up beautiful, unbloated, clear-skinned, fluffy-haired, fearless, lucky in love, calm and confident. Her life was easy. She haunted me like a ghost. I tried so hard to be her. In my 30s, I gave that ghost the finger. I quit trying to be the perfect woman and decided to celebrate my imperfection. I claimed a new identity, jacked up human. I announced to anyone who would listen, "I'm a hot mess and proud of it. I love this crappy version of humanity that I am. I am broken and beautiful. F you, perfect woman." The problem was that I still believed that there was an ideal human and that I was not her. The problem was that I still believed in ghosts. I had just decided to live in defiance of perfection instead of in pursuit of it. Rebellion is as much of a cage as obedience is. They both mean living in reaction to someone else's way instead of forging your own. Freedom is not being for or against an idea, but creating your own from scratch. A few years ago, Oprah Winfrey was interviewing me about my first memoir. She opened the book and read my words back to me. "I was born a little broken." Then she paused, looked up from the page, and asked, "Would you still describe yourself that way? As broken?" Her eyes sparkled. I looked at her and said, "No, actually, I wouldn't. That's ridiculous. I think this sort of thing is why Jesus only wrote in the sand. Broken means does not function as it was designed to function. A broken human is one who does not function the way humans are designed to function. When I think about my own human experience, what honest people have told me about their human experiences, and the experiences of every historical and contemporary human being I've ever studied, we all seem to function in the exact same way. We hurt people, and we are hurt by people. We feel left out envious, not good enough, sick, and tired. We have unrealized dreams and deep regrets. We are certain that we were meant for more and that we don't even deserve what we have. We feel ecstatic and then numb. We wish our parents had done better by us. We wish we could do better by our children. We betray and we are betrayed. We lie and we are lied to. We say goodbye to animals, to places, to people we cannot live without. We are so afraid of dying, also of living. We have fallen in love and out of love, and people have fallen in love and out of love with us. We wonder if what happened to us that night will mean we can never be touched again without fear. We live with rage bubbling. We are sweaty, bloated, gassy, oily. We love our children. We long for children. We do not want children. We are at war with our bodies, our minds, our souls. We are at war with one another. We wish we'd said all those things while they were still here. They're still here, and we're still not saying those things. We know we won't. We don't understand ourselves. We don't understand why we hurt those we love. We want to be forgiven. We cannot forgive. We don't understand God. We believe. We absolutely do not believe. We are lonely. We want to be left alone. We want to belong. We want to be loved. We want to be loved. We want to be loved. If this is our shared human experience, where did we get the idea that there is some other, better, more perfect, unbroken way to be human? Where is the human being who is functioning correctly, against whom we are all judging our performances? Who is she? Where is she? What is her life if it is not these things? I got free the moment I realized that my problem isn't that I'm not a good enough human. My problem is that I'm not a good enough ghost. Since I don't have to be a ghost, I don't have a problem. If you are uncomfortable, in deep pain, angry, yearning, confused, you don't have a problem. You have a life. Being human is not hard because you're doing it wrong. It's hard because you're doing it right. You will never change the fact that being human is hard, so you must change your idea that it was ever supposed to be easy. I will not call myself broken, flawed, or imperfect anymore. I will quit chasing ghosts because the chase left me weary and because I am a woman who no longer believes in ghosts. Allow me to rewrite my own self-description. I am 44 years old. With all my chin hairs and pain and contradictions, I am flawless, unbroken. There is no other way. I am haunted by nothing. Smiles. Two Christmases ago, my sister and I presented our parents with a check to buy themselves a trip to Paris. They were so touched and proud that they framed the check, uncashed, and hung it on their living room wall. This year, we doubled down. We bought 4 plane tickets to Paris and decided to hand deliver our parents to the city they had always wanted to visit. We stayed in a tiny apartment overlooking the Eiffel Tower. I had never been to Europe before. I was charmed. Paris is elegant and old. Being there made me feel elegant and young. It helped me forgive America for our arrogance and fury. In Paris, surrounded by ruins of ancient baths, guillotines, and churches more than 1,000 years old, humanity's mistakes and beauty are unfurled like a mural. In America, we are so new. We still fancy ourselves conquerors and renegades. We're all still trying to be the firsts to do this or that. Can you imagine? We are all competing for our parents' attention, and we have no parents. It makes us a little jumpy. Paris is not jumpy. Paris is calm and certain. It's not going to startle easily, and it already knows the words to all the songs. Everywhere I looked in Paris, I found proof that leaders come and go, buildings are built and fall, revolutions begin and end, nothing, no matter how grand, lasts. Paris says, "We are here for such a short time. We might as well sit down for a long while with some good coffee, company, and bread." There is more time for being human there. Maybe because there has just been more time to learn how. When we visited the Louvre, we entered the Mona Lisa room and found a crowd of hundreds pushing, jostling, selfieing all around her. I stared from a distance, trying to appreciate her. I really didn't understand what all the fuss was about. I wondered if all the jostling people understood or if they were just acting like they did. A woman walked over and stood next to me. She said, "You know, there's a theory about her smile. Want to hear it?" "Yes, please," I said. Mona Lisa and her husband lost a baby. Sometime later, her husband commissioned this painting from Da Vinci to celebrate the birth of another baby. Mona Lisa sat for Leonardo to paint her, but she wouldn't smile during the sitting. Not all the way. The story goes that Da Vinci wanted her to smile wider, but she refused. She did not want the joy she felt for her new baby to erase the pain she felt from losing the first. There in her half smile is her half joy. Or maybe it's her full joy and her full grief all at the same time. She has the look of a woman who has just realized a dream but still carries the lost dream inside her. She wanted her whole life to be present on her face. She wanted everyone to remember, so she wouldn't pretend. Now I understand what the fuss is all about. Mona Lisa is the patron saint of honest, resolute, fully human women, women who feel and who know. She is saying for us, "Don't tell me to smile. I will not be pleasant. Even trapped here, inside two dimensions, you will see the truth. You will see my life's brutal and beautiful right here on my face. The world will not be able to stop staring." Goals. When I got pregnant with Chase and quit drinking, drugging, and purging, I thought it might be my last chance to stop being bad and start being good. I married Chase's father, and I learned to cook and clean and fake orgasms. I was a good wife. I had three babies and put all their needs so far ahead of my own that I forgot I had needs at all. I was a good mom. I started going to church and learned to fear God and not ask too many questions of folks who claimed to represent God. I was a good Christian. I watched beauty trends carefully, and I dyed my hair and paid to get poison injected into my forehead so I wouldn't look too tired from all the effort it takes to be good at beauty. I started writing and released bestsellers and spoke to sold-out audiences all over the country. A woman isn't allowed to do well unless she also does good, so I became a do-gooder for the world. I raised tens of millions of dollars for people who were hurting, and I lost a decade of sleep writing back to strangers. "You are a good woman, Glennon," they said. I was. I was so good. I was also exhausted, anxious, and lost. I assumed that was because I wasn't good enough yet. I just had to try a little harder. My husband's infidelity was a jagged gift because it forced me to see that being a good wife wasn't enough to keep my marriage together. Being a good mother wasn't enough to keep my kids from pain. Being a good world saver wasn't enough to save my own world. Being bad had almost killed me, but so had being good. I was talking to a dear friend around that time. She said, "Gee, remember that amazing Steinbeck quote? And now that you don't have to be perfect, you can be good." I've kept it on my desk for years. I looked at it last night and thought, I'm tired of being good. I'm so tired. Let's change it to, "And now that we don't have to be good, we can be free." Adam and Keys. A few years ago, Alicia Keys announced to the world that she was done wearing makeup. She said, "I don't want to cover up anymore. Not my face, not my mind, not my soul, not my thoughts, not my dreams, not my struggles, nothing." That's it, I thought. A while later, I read an interview with Adam Levine. He said that while they were filming a show together, he poked his head into Alicia Keys' dressing room. She had her back to him, and she was leaning into the mirror, putting on lipstick. He smiled and said, "Oh, I thought Alicia doesn't wear makeup." She turned around, looked at him, lipstick in her hand. She said, "I do what the fuck I want." That's it. Ears. My daughters are different. I raised Tish while I was still trying to be a good parent, but then I got tired. By the time Amma exited the birth canal, I'd just handed her an iPad and wished the child Godspeed on her journey. One way to describe Amma is independent. Another is on her own. This parenting approach, retreat, has served her well. She wears what she wants and says what she wants, and mostly she does what she wants. She has created herself, and she is a glorious invention with which she is well pleased. Recently, we were sitting around the kitchen table, and Tish mentioned her need to train more if she ever hoped to be great at soccer. We asked Amma if she felt the same way. Amma took a bite of her pizza and said, "Nah, I'm already great." She is 12. Maybe 11, actually. I have three children, and their ages change every single year. All I know is they are in the phase that comes after crawling but before college, somewhere in that sweet spot. Years ago, when I was in the thick of deciding whether I wanted to save or end my marriage, the girls began begging to get their ears pierced. I was grateful for the distraction, so I said yes. I took them to the mall, and when we arrived at the piercing kiosk, Amma ran ahead of me, leaped into the piercing chair, and announced to the surprised 20-something piercer, "Let's do this." When I finally caught up, the piercer turned to me and said, "Are you her mother?" "I am trying to be," I said. "Okay, do you want me to pierce her ears one at a time or both at the same time?" Amma said, "Both. Do it. Let's go." Then she squinted her eyes, gritted her teeth, and flexed all her muscles like a tiny Hulk. As they pierced her, I saw a couple of tears that she wiped away immediately. I looked at Amma and thought, she is so awesome. She is also 6 years from a felony. She jumped down from the chair, buzzing with adrenaline. The women working at the kiosk laughed and said, "Wow, she is so brave." Tish stood next to me, taking all of it in. She motioned for me to lean down closer. She whispered, "Actually, Mom, I changed my mind. I don't want to get my ears pierced today." "Are you sure?" I asked. She looked over at Amma's earlobes, swollen grape tomatoes. Amma said, "Come on, Tish, you only live once." Tish said, "Why does everyone say that when they're about to do dangerous things? How about you only live once, so don't get dead early?" Then she looked back at me and said, "I'm sure." The piercer turned to Tish and said, "Your turn, honey." I waited for Tish to speak. She said, "No, thank you. I'm not ready today." The piercer said, "Oh, come on. You can do it. Be brave. Look how brave your little sister was." Tish looked at me, and I squeezed her hand as we walked away. She felt a little ashamed, and I felt a lot annoyed. I don't think brave means what we've been saying it means. We tell our children that brave means feeling afraid and doing it anyway, but is this the definition we want them to carry as they grow older? When she is 17, headed out in a car driven by her teenage buddy, saying she's going to the movies but actually going to that kegger down the street, imagine calling to her, "Bye, babe, be brave tonight." What I mean by that is, if you're in a scary situation and you feel afraid to do what your friends are encouraging you to do, I want you to ignore that fear and do it anyway. Just plow right through that gut instinct of yours. No. That is not the understanding of being brave I want my children to have. I do not want my children to become people who abandon themselves to please the crowd. Brave does not mean feeling afraid and doing it anyway. Brave means living from the inside out. Brave means, in every uncertain moment, turning inward, feeling for the knowing, and speaking it out loud. Since the knowing is specific, personal, and ever-changing, so is brave. Whether you are brave or not cannot be judged by people on the outside. Sometimes being brave requires letting the crowd think you're a coward. Sometimes being brave means letting everyone down but yourself. Amma's brave is often loud and go for it. Tish's brave is often quiet and wait for it. They are both brave girls because each is true to herself. They are not divided between what they feel and know on the inside and what they say and do on the outside. Their selves are integrated. They have integrity. Tish showed tremendous bravery that day because keeping her integrity required her to resist the pressure of the crowd. She trusted her own voice more than she trusted the voices of others. Brave is not asking the crowd what is brave. Brave is deciding for oneself. On the way home from the mall, I said, "Tish, I know that lady made you feel unbrave today. People have different ideas about what's brave. You did the brave thing, because the brave thing is doing what your knowing tells you to do. You don't ask others what's brave. You feel and know what's brave. What you know to do might be the opposite of what others are telling you to do. It takes special bravery to honor yourself when the crowd is pressuring you not to. It's easier just to give in. You didn't give in to the crowd today. You stood strong in what you felt and knew. To me, that's the greatest bravery. That's true confidence, which means loyalty to self. That's what you move through the world with, Tish, confidence. Regardless of what others are calling brave at the moment, you stay loyal to yourself. If you keep living with confidence, the rest of your life will unfold exactly as it should. It won't always be comfortable. Some will recognize you're brave, others won't. Some will understand and like you, others won't. But the way others respond to your confidence is not your business. Your business is to stay loyal to you. That way, you will always know that those who do like and love you are really your people. You'll never be forced to hide or act in order to keep people if you don't hide or act to get them. To be brave is to forsake all others, to be true to yourself. That is the vow of a confident girl. Terms. I met Liz at an airport. We were speaking at the same event somewhere out west. I flew all night to get there and then found myself in a small terminal, standing outside a circle made up of other speakers waiting to be picked up and delivered to the event. I hate how people stand in circles. I wish we'd all agree to stand around in horseshoes with room available for awkward outsiders to join. A woman walked over from baggage claim and stood next to me. I smiled and stayed quiet, which is my strategy for making it through. She smiled back, but her smile was different from mine. My smile says, "Hello, I am warm, polite, and unavailable." I smile like a period. Liz smiles slowly and openly, like a question mark. "Hi, I'm Liz." "I know," I said. "I adore your work. I'm Glennon." "Oh my gosh, I know you. I adore your work too. Where are you from?" "I live in Naples, Florida." "What's it like to live there?" "It's slow. It's a retirement city. I'd say the average age in my neighborhood is 80. The cool thing is that most of my friends are turning 40 and worried about starting to look old. Not me. I feel fantastic, like a spring chicken. I go to the gym, look around at all the grandparents, and think, actually, I don't need to work out after all. I look amazing. It's all perspective, right? I tell my friends to skip the Botox and just move to Naples." Liz says, "Wonderful. How did you end up there?" "I got neurological Lyme disease a few years ago. My entire body shut down, and I was in bed for 2 years and popping 50 pills a day. I went to stay in my friend's place in Naples, and I felt so much better. I moved there temporarily, and I was able to ditch the pills, so I just stayed. I've always known I wanted to live by the beach. I guess women have to almost die before we give ourselves permission to live how we want." Liz put her hand on my arm and said, "Wait, wow. That last thing you said about having to almost die, can you say that again?" I said, "I don't think so. I'm a little nervous. I have no idea what I just said." She smiled and said, "I like you. I like you too." The next night, along with everyone else at the convention, I went to see Liz speak. I got to the event early and claimed a seat in the front, but off to the side, close enough to see her clearly, but not close enough for her to see me clearly. She was standing behind the podium, wearing a black shirt with a high white collar, and she reminded me of a priest at a pulpit. When she started speaking, I found myself holding my breath. She spoke with gentleness and authority. A man in the front row kept talking to the woman beside him, and Liz paused mid-sentence, turned to him, and asked him to stop talking. He did. Something about the way she spoke, the way she carried herself, made my heart beat quicker than usual. She seemed certain, steady, free, relaxed. She was not complying, and she was not rebelling. She was creating something new. She was original. I wanted to ask, can you say all that again? The next night, all the speakers attended a fancy banquet in a ski lodge at the top of a mountain. Snow was flurrying outside the floor-to-ceiling windows, and people were flurrying inside, trying to figure out where to stand and who was important enough to talk to. I saw Liz in a corner across the room, surrounded. My general policy is to honor people I admire by leaving them alone. I didn't that night. I walked over to her, and when she saw me, she smiled like another beginning. I drew closer, joined the huddle. The entire circle was pressing Liz with questions and requests for advice like she was a vending machine. I wanted to step on their toes. After a while, the host of the event walked over and said to Liz, "It's time to take our seats for dinner. May I lead you to your table?" Liz pointed to me and asked, "Can I sit with my friend?" The woman looked nervous, then apologetic. "I'm sorry, we've promised the donors that you'd sit with them." "Okay," she said. She looked forlorn. She squeezed my arm and said, "I'll miss you." During the dinner, I thought about how much I liked Liz and how sad it was that we wouldn't actually be able to be friends. Attempting to be her friend would be like intentionally writing a bad check. I am not a good friend. I have never been capable of or willing to commit to the maintenance that the rules of friendship dictate. I cannot remember birthdays. I do not want to meet for coffee. I will not host the baby shower. I won't text back because it's an eternal game of ping pong, the texting. It never ends. I inevitably disappoint friends, so after enough of that, I decided I would stop trying. I don't want to live in constant debt. This is okay with me. I have a sister and children and a dog. One cannot have it all. A few weeks after the event, Liz sent me an email saying she thought we should try friendship. She sent along this poem. "I honor your gods. I drink at your well. I bring an undefended heart to our meeting place. I have no cherished outcomes. I will not negotiate by withholding. I am not subject to disappointment." She offered a new friendship memo. That for us, there would be no arbitrary rules, obligations, or expectations. We would not owe each other anything other than admiration, respect, love. And that was all done already. We became friends. A while later, I invited Liz to come stay with me. It was shortly after I'd met Abby, and I was walking through my days stunned. I was deeply in love for the first time in my life, and I had told no one except my sister about any of it. Liz and I stayed up late that first night, talking about everything but my desperate heart and aching body and muddled mind. The next morning, my alarm rang at 5:30, which didn't matter because I didn't sleep anymore. I rolled over and tiptoed to the kitchen so I wouldn't wake Liz upstairs. I took my coffee outside and stood in my backyard. It was still dark and cold, but the pink-tinged horizon hinted at the coming sun. I stood there, stared at the sky, and, as I'd done each day since I met Abby, I thought, "Help, please." In that moment, I was reminded of a story about a woman who had become stranded on top of an icy mountain. She frantically prayed that God would rescue her before she froze to death. She called to the heavens, "If you exist, God, send help." A little while later, a helicopter circled above and dropped a ladder. "No," the woman said, "go away. I'm waiting for God." Then a park ranger walked by and asked, "Need some help, sister?" "No, go away. I'm waiting for God." The woman froze to death. She showed up at the gates of heaven, pissed, and demanded, "Why, God? Why did you let me die?" God said, "Honey, I sent a helicopter. I sent a park ranger. What the hell were you waiting for?" I thought, I am freezing to death while Liz frickin' Gilbert, a friend I admire, trust, and love, who happens to also be a world-renowned spiritual teacher, is asleep upstairs. Maybe Liz is my park ranger. When she woke up, Liz found me at the bottom of the stairs in my pajamas, teary, desperate, humbled. I said, "I need you." She said, "Okay, honey head." We sat down on my couch and I spilled it all. I told her about how Abby and I had met, how we'd spent the past weeks falling deeper in love through emails, how our letters felt like blood transfusions. Each one I read and wrote pumped fresh life through my veins. I told her how ridiculous and impossible it all was. It was thrilling and terrifying to hear the words fall out of my mouth like I was crossing some point of no return. I was expecting her to be shocked. She was not shocked. Her eyes were sparkly, lovingly amused, soft, smiling. She looked relieved somehow. I said, "It will never work out." She said, "Maybe not. Maybe she's just an Abby-shaped door inviting you to leave what's not true enough anymore." I said, "It will ruin Craig." She said, "There is no such thing as one-way liberation, honey." I said, "Can you imagine the havoc this would wreak on my parents, on my friends, on my career?" She said, "Yes, everyone you love would be uncomfortable for a long while, maybe. What is better, uncomfortable truth or comfortable lies? Every truth is a kindness, even if it makes others uncomfortable. Every untruth is an unkindness, even if it makes others comfortable." I said, "I barely know her." She said, "But you do know yourself." I said, "What if I leave for her and this isn't even real?" She looked at me. She did not say anything. We sat together in the quiet. She held my hand, lightly, lovingly. I said, "I am real. What I feel and want and know, that's all real." "Yes," Liz said, "you are real." It is a blessing to know a free woman. Sometimes she will stop by and hold up a mirror for you. She will help you remember who you are. Erica's. Recently, my friend Erica called my cell phone. I will never understand why people insist upon calling my cell phone. It's such an aggressive action to take, calling someone. Each time my phone rings, I have a heart attack, like my pocket's on fire and a tiny siren is going off. I'd also like to take this opportunity to address texting. Texting is better than calling. Unless you are one of those people who doles out texts like IOUs. Unless you believe that whenever you feel like it, you can just poke at me, ping me, jump into my day like, "Hi," and feel so entitled to a response that the next time I see you, you will arrange your face in an injured manner and say quietly, "Hey, you doing okay? I just never heard back." At this moment, I have 183 unread texts. Texts are not the boss of me, and neither is anybody who texts me. I have decided once and for all that just because someone texts me does not obligate me to respond. If I believed differently, I'd walk around all day feeling anxious and indebted, responding instead of creating. Now that we've established why I have no friends, let's return to Erica. Erica and I went to college together. She was a born artist, but she studied business because her mother was a corporate executive and wanted Erica to become one too. Erica resented every minute she spent in those business classes. It's nearly impossible to blaze one's own path while following in someone else's footsteps. Erica returned to our dorm each day and recovered from her business boredom by painting. She graduated with a business degree and then fell in love with a fantastic guy and worked in a corporate office to put him through medical school. Next, the babies came and she quit her job to stay home and care for them. All the while, she heard a voice nagging her to start painting again. One day, she told me she planned to honor that longing, to honor herself by enrolling in art school. I heard fizz and fire in her voice for the first time in a decade. So I answered the phone in celebration of Erica's commitment, and I said, "Hey, how is school going?" She was quiet for a moment and then said, "Oh, that. That was silly. Brett is so busy and the kids need me. Art school just seemed so selfish after a while. Why do women find it honorable to dismiss ourselves? Why do we decide that denying our longing is the responsible thing to do? Why do we believe that what will thrill and fulfill us will hurt our people? Why do we mistrust ourselves so completely? Here's why. Because our culture was built upon and benefits from the control of women. The way power justifies controlling a group is by conditioning the masses to believe that the group cannot be trusted. So the campaign to convince us to mistrust women begins early and comes from everywhere. When we are little girls, our families, teachers, and peers insist that our loud voices, bold opinions, and strong feelings are too much and unladylike. So we learn to not trust our personalities. Childhood stories promise us that girls who dare to leave the path or explore get attacked by big bad wolves and pricked by deadly spindles. So we learn to not trust our curiosity. The beauty industry convinces us that our thighs, frizz, skin, fingernails, lips, eyelashes, leg hair, and wrinkles are repulsive and must be covered and manipulated. So we learn to not trust the bodies we live in. Diet culture promises us that controlling our appetite is the key to our worthiness. So we learn to not trust our own hunger. Politicians insist that our judgment about our bodies and futures cannot be trusted. So our own reproductive systems must be controlled by lawmakers we don't know in places we've never been. The legal system proves to us again and again that even our own memories and experiences will not be trusted. If 20 women come forward and say he did it, and he says, no, I didn't, they will believe him while discounting and maligning us every damn time. And religion, sweet Jesus. The lesson of Adam and Eve, the first formative story I was told about God and woman, was this. When a woman wants more, she defies God, betrays her partner, curses her family, and destroys the world. We weren't born distrusting and fearing ourselves. That was part of our taming. We were taught to believe that who we are in our natural state is bad and dangerous. They convinced us to be afraid of ourselves. So we do not honor our own bodies, curiosity, hunger, judgment, experience, or ambition. Instead, we lock away our true selves. Women who are best at this disappearing act earn the highest praise. She is so selfless. Can you imagine? The epitome of womanhood is to lose oneself completely. That is the end goal of every patriarchal culture, because a very effective way to control women is to convince women to control themselves. I tried to control myself for so long. I spent 30 years covering and injecting my face with potions and poisons, trying to fix my skin. Then I quit. And my skin was good. For 20 years, I was attached to a hairdryer and straightener, trying to tame my curls. Then I quit. And my hair was good. I binged and purged and dieted for decades, trying to control my body. When I quit, my body became what it was always meant to become. And it was good too. I numbed myself with food and booze, trying to control my anger. When I quit, I learned that my anger never meant that there was something wrong with me. It meant that there was something wrong out there, something I might have the power to change. I stopped being a quiet peacekeeper and started being a loud peacemaker. My anger was good. I had been deceived. The only thing that was ever wrong with me was my belief that there was something wrong with me. I quit spending my life trying to control myself and began to trust myself. We only control what we don't trust. We can either control ourselves or love ourselves, but we can't do both. Love is the opposite of control. Love demands trust. I love myself now. Self-love means that I have a relationship with myself built on trust and loyalty. I trust myself to have my own back, so my allegiance is to the voice within. I'll abandon everyone else's expectations of me before I'll abandon myself. I'll disappoint everyone else before I'll disappoint myself. I'll forsake all others before I'll forsake myself. Me and myself, we are till death do us part. What the world needs is more women who have quit fearing themselves and started loving themselves. What the world needs is masses of women who are entirely out of control. Beach houses. I wrote to my community recently, "Do with yourself whatever it is you want to do. You can trust yourself." Someone responded, "Isn't it irresponsible to suggest that we should do whatever we want to do? Most nights, by the time I get home, I want to drink an entire bottle of Malibu. Pretty sure I shouldn't trust all of my desires." I have a friend who has struggled mightily with money for decades. She recently told me that she was this close to renting an expensive beach house, even though she was deep in debt. She knew from her roots that she couldn't trust this desire of hers, but she wanted this vacation for her family so badly that she was prepared to allow her desire to override her knowing. When I asked why she was so desperate for this house, she looked down at her hands and said, "I see all the pictures on social media of families at the shore. They're relaxing together. They're off their damn phones and just being together. My family is so disconnected right now. The kids are growing so fast. Tom and I never really talk anymore. I feel like we're losing each other. I want to slow down. I want to talk to my kids and husband more. I want to know what's going on in their lives. I want to have fun together again." Instead of renting the beach house, my friend bought a $2 basket and placed it on a table in her foyer. She asked her husband and teenagers to leave their phones in the basket for an hour each weeknight. Her family began preparing, eating, and cleaning up after dinner together. There was a lot of grumbling about this new system at first, but then came the laughter, talking, and connection she'd yearned for. Her basket turned out to be a $2 beach house. So that woman's nightly desire for a bottle of Malibu, that was just a surface desire. I know this because her knowing didn't trust it. A surface desire is one that conflicts with our knowing. We must ask of our surface desires, what is the desire beneath this desire? Is it rest? Is it peace? Our deep desires are wise, true, beautiful, and things we can grant ourselves without abandoning our knowing. Following our deep desire always returns us to integrity. If your desire feels wrong to you, go deeper. You can trust yourself. You just have to get low enough. I have spent the last decade of my life listening to women talk about what they most desire. This is what women tell me they want. I want a minute to take a deep breath. I want rest, peace, passion. I want good food and true, wild, intimate sex. I want relationships with no lies. I want to be comfortable in my own skin. I want to be seen, to be loved. I want joy and safety for my children and for everyone else's children. I want justice for all. I want help, community, and connection. I want to be forgiven, and I want to finally forgive. I want enough money and power to stop feeling afraid. I want to find my purpose down here and live it out fully. I want to look at the news and see less pain, more love. I want to look at the people in my life and really see them and love them. I want to look in the mirror and really see myself and love myself. I want to feel alive. The blueprints of heaven are etched in the deep desires of women. What women want is good. What women want is beautiful. And what women want is dangerous, but not to women, not to the common good. What women want is a threat to the injustice of the status quo. If we unlocked and unleashed ourselves, imbalanced relationships would be equalized, children would be fed, corrupt governments would topple, wars would end, civilizations would be transformed. If women trusted and claimed their desires, the world as we know it would crumble. Perhaps that is precisely what needs to happen so that we can rebuild truer, more beautiful lives, relationships, families, and nations in their place. Maybe Eve was never meant to be our warning. Maybe she was meant to be our model. Own your wanting. Eat the apple. Let it burn. Temperatures. One morning, I called my friend Martha and began telling her all the reasons I could not leave my marriage. Then I began sharing all the reasons I could not stay in my marriage. I kept talking, weighing every angle, arguing myself into corners and then around and round in circles. Eventually, she said, "Glennon, stop. You are in your head. The answers you need this time aren't in there. They're in your body. Try dropping into your body. Right now, on the phone, drop lower." This was becoming a theme in my life, all this sinking and dropping. She asked, "You in there yet?" "I think so," I said. "Okay, now consider both decisions. Inhabit yourself and feel. Does saying goodbye to Abby feel warm to you?" "No. That feels cold, actually. It feels icy. It makes me feel like I'll die of cold." "Now consider being with Abby. How does that feel?"
"It feels warm, soft, spacious."
"Okay, Glennon, your body is nature, and nature is pure. I know that's hard for you to accept because you've been at war with your body for so long. You think your body is bad, but it's not. It's wise. Your body will tell you things your mind will talk you out of. Your body is telling you what direction life is in. Try trusting it. Turn away from what feels cold. Go toward what feels warm. Now, when I sense danger, I believe the cold and leave. When I sense joy, I believe the warm and stay." These days in business meetings, when I request an explanation for a decision someone has made, the women on my team know that I'm not looking for justifications, judgments, or opinions. I'm looking for knowing. So the decision maker will say, "I did the research and sat with these options for a while. This option felt warm to me. The alternative felt cold." That will be the end of the discussion. I trust women who trust themselves. Mirrors. For a long while, I pretended not to know that even though I had only one life,